Welcome to the inaugural show zero of the Babylon podcast. My name is Summer Brooks.
I'm going to put that on and go into the spot factory and get to work.
My dog and I are being attacked by a duck.
I think I'm kidding, but I'm not.
When you're hungry, you're hungry.
The virgin sits on a crate, opening and closing his pipe.
Stuff has a mind of its own tonight.
I didn't get any entries at all.
Telepaths against mundanes is no contest.
I like Day of the Dead.
I did too.
Hey guys, it's Gary. I'm listening to episode 1.
And God help us all, this is Joe Truman.
Production of the malt liquor beverage Zima.
Nice and close, and I looked at him and I go, do you want?
Hey there. Okay, I'm... Actually, let me call you back in a minute. Bye.
Stella, I knew it was a bad idea to record. I knew it was.
And yes, we're back for even more Babylon podcast. I'm Summer Brooks.
I'm Tim Callender.
And this is John from Jersey.
Back again. Thanks for staying with us for another week, John.
My pleasure.
I think Brett passed out.
Mugged by his kids.
No, he passed out from the thought of more emo path.
Maybe the emo paths got to him.
There you go. Yes, we're gonna, I don't know, should we just run right into it, just keep on discussing?
We could do that. Again, I don't have a whole lot of news. I was sitting here on my handy-dandy iPhone looking for anything about what JMS is up to, and there's an article about how he's approaching his upcoming run on Wonder Woman. And it's kind of intriguing. Let me just share this. The question from the interviewer, and I'll have to post this up on the... Oh, Big Shiny Robot is the name of the blog, so for what that's worth. But they ask him, what are you most excited about bringing to the table with Wonder Woman? And JMS responds, one of the things I enjoy most is parking the magical next door to the mundane, the surreal next to the real. I think the contrast throws both into stark relief and allows for counterpoint and thematic motifs that you just can't get otherwise. So the chance to play in that playground with Diana is very exciting to me. So, and then to some of the points about what he's going to be changing in the universe, he makes a comment, her character is solid, the writers who have written her are terrific, but over the decades the world around her has constricted and gotten more insular and less accessible to newer casual readers, so the key was to move her away from that environment and put her into another one where her character could be more easily and accessibly seen. You can have the best garden in the world, but if you can't see it for all the brush, then the solution is to clear the brush. So, there you go. To that point, I think we're going to clear some brushes around what we think should have happened or was supposed to happen in B5, right?
Yes, we are. So, let's take a really, really quick break and then jump back into the deep end of the pool.
So, you're still hanging on to that tiny thread of denial, trying to convince yourself that sci-fi has nothing whatsoever to do with your life. Well, you better think again, Sparky. That tiny cell phone has no basis in Starfleet communicators. Those hands-free earpieces now used by virtually everybody didn't come down from the ear of Lieutenant Uhura. And that cute little Rumba vacuum cleaner that you use far too infrequently wasn't hijacked off an Imperial Star Cruiser. Nah, not a chance. Because if it were true, then you would be forced to turn on that Flash Gordon-inspired box on your desk called a computer and listen to sliceofsci-fi.com. The podcast and XM satellite radio show that will turn your sci-fi into reality.
Digging down to the minutest arcani of the B5 universe, this is Deep Geeking.
Ah, Yes. Where have all the telepaths gone? Long time coming.
If you're going to Brown Sector, be sure to put some conditioner in your hair. yeah.
Let's just say that JMS was ahead of his time. Let's just put it that way.
Yes, I think so.
Goodness. The thought that JMS's group of emotionally affected telepaths in down below may have inspired Twilight really, really hurts. Mentally, emotionally.
Physically, because I think I'm going to start hitting myself.
That's one way to explore that choices have consequences. Prell.
yeah.
So, Tim, I believe that last week you discussed that you had some thoughts on telepaths and some changes or some differences that might have gone over the years.
Yes, and none of them would have had to do with emopaths, really.
Thank God.
yeah. Here's kind of the general thing. We all know that midway through the second season, Andrea Thompson wanted out of B5 because she felt she wasn't getting enough screen time or whatever exactly. That's one of those. She decided she wanted out, and so we got divided loyalties toward the end of season two, where all of a sudden it's revealed that Talia Winters has had a sleeper personality driving her to become close to the Babylon 5 command staff in order to discover whatever it is that was there to discover. And while it's obvious that was JMS trying to, well, just let's make this one just a clean break and not try to drag it out. The fact of the matter is, similar to the Sinclair stories lines that were set up in the first season, a lot of the stuff set up in the second season with Talia Winters were obviously heading in a completely different direction. And yeah, some of that was eventually taken up in Lita's story, but I think it would have developed differently ultimately. And I don't know that we would have gotten emopaths when all was said and done. So, you know, I'm just thinking, you know, first of all, we get in Deathwalker, the business with the Vicar and Kosh,
mm-hmm.
and Talia, and the data crystal, what's on it. You know, to me, that indicates that somewhere down the line, Talia would have had a big role to play in something. That Kosh felt it was important to basically do a backup of her personality.
I thought that they were going to use that as information to counter the shadows for when they did put telepaths in the ships.
Sure. I mean, maybe, but that's not at all what we got
after
departure.
You see, for me at least, I think we still would have had, perhaps not emopaths, but I still think we would have had the colony of telepaths, because Talia's arc was the true believer in the Psi Corps, and it would have made sense for her to become the true believer on the side of the rogues by the end.
Yeah, yeah,
so that tracks for me.
Yeah, right. That's the arc I could see happening, because You saw her lose a little bit of faith in, you know, the Corps' mother, the Corps' father, with Ironheart.
Right.
And then you saw more of that when she helped them escape from Bester.
Right, in A Race Through Dark Places. And that was, I mean, that was the one episode where she really, you know, the scales have to fall from her eyes to see what they're up against. But, you know, the alterations that she got from Ironheart, I don't know that that Talia would have been as hooked into the Vorlons as Lita was?
Except for perhaps maybe that's what the whole recording was to help facilitate. And it would have maybe made the Vorlons' involvement with the telepaths, and specifically Talia, even more sinister.
Hmm. Well, here's a thought from the chat room. Edmund is speculating that maybe the recording was there to restore Talia's original personality after the sleeper was activated. And that totally switches, because I always thought she arrived at B5 with the sleeper agent already implanted. Had been on B5 and then went back and then was implanted with it, that would have been interesting.
Yeah, but at no point do we ever really see that she ever leaves the station.
Don't they refer to it now and then? Or was that just Lita that they said that about?
Yeah, that was just Lita. I don't recall.
Lita was gone for an extended period of time. There were a couple of episodes where Talia wasn't there.
But that's not necessarily proof that she was not on the station.
Right. Mm. Right.
You know, and I'm looking here on the Lurker's Guide. This is what Kosh says about the data crystal. You know, what's on it? He says reflection, surprise, terror for the future. Right. Now, even given the Vorlon penchant for obfuscation, to me, that doesn't necessarily. I don't know. I don't know. I'm not quite sure how to. I'm not being particularly.
Well, if we buy into
precise with my thoughts now, I'm sorry.
If we buy into the idea that Lita's general character arc was effectively maybe 75% to 80% what Talia was supposed to do, then we know that Lita eventually came to the point where she was very bitter about what the Vorlons had done in terms of the genetic manipulation to create telepaths and the manipulation that went on to make them fodder against the shadows. So again, I'm thinking that may have had some tie in there. Of course, we don't know because it was just one of those dangling things. And what's really annoying is that he dangled it out at the end of Divided Loyalties as if to make the point that, yes, she's leaving, but this still has something to do with the story.
Yes.
It went nowhere.
Right. Right. Yeah.
Well, the speculation may be that with Talia, she was going to be the weapon. You know, her abilities were going to keep becoming enhanced because of what Ironheart did to her. And when she left, that had to be molded onto Lita somehow. And that brought about the Vorlon manipulation of her rather than the advanced manipulation of Talia by Ironheart. So maybe that's what was recorded to restore her after the implanted personality was taken over. That's one theory.
Yeah, I just think the way that whole implanted personality was introduced, dealt with, and dismissed within the space of one episode, to me, smacks more of JMS going, well, how do I write her out of the show? And, you know, similar to the jump between Chrysalis and Points of Departure, it was just like, there's no real good way to do this, so let me just, you know, it's like ripping off a Band-Aid. You know? Just might as well grab it and yank it and scream, but then it's over with, and you're on your way. And to me, that's the sense of it, is that, you know, the actress wanted it off. You didn't have the same kind of deal like with Michael O'Hare. Everything that I've read regarding Sinclair's reappearance toward the end of season 2 as Ranger 1 and, of course, in War Without End was that in his departure, you know, Joe said, well, you know, I know that you know, for all the various reasons that you're departing. But if we could bring you back, would you be open to doing, you know, a shot here and there? And apparently that was so. And so they could make that work and make it make sense in the grand scheme of things.
You know, it just occurred to me that if we take the whole sleeper personality part out, maybe there is an explanation for Talia's arc that makes sense if you go back to that whole Ironheart thing that Summer was talking about. Because if you remember, in that episode, they made a big point of how a lot of the telekinetics were mentally unstable. And if you go with this idea that she started out with whatever Ironheart gave her, but it was something that would build over time with maybe practice or just as a natural evolution, just as he was kind of forced along that same line, that maybe there would have been a natural breakdown of her mind. And maybe that's what the recording was supposed to help with, was to mitigate what was a side effect that the Vorlons knew came along with enhancing a telepath to give them the telekinetic abilities.
Well, that's interesting, John, and I think that would have been intriguing to see.
And that actually falls into the original description of the telepaths in the very first series description, because in there it says that a lot of telepaths burn out because they are pushed to try to achieve higher P ratings. When during the series, it's, you know, whatever you're born at, you're born at. That's what, you know, a P5 is always a P5 is always a P5. I mean, we even had Bester say it. But in the original description of telepaths, it seemed like somebody could have an initial rating of a P4 and the Psi-Cor had ways to push them up to maybe a P6 or a P7. You know?
Right.
So
right.
I wonder if through pushing a P4 up two levels or three levels, if somehow during that process it breaks them, because it actually specifically says that there's a lot of telepaths who burn out their abilities trying to achieve a higher rating.
Well, to that point, Ironheart and makes mention of the fact that the core and Bester, even in Dust to Dust, refers to dust as a drug that was used to try to increase, if only temporarily, the P rating of a telepath. Right. So if they're burning out, it could be, I mean, this gets back to the whole nefarious qualities of Psi-Cor to begin with. They're burning out not because they're trying, but because somebody's pushing them. And they're just, you know, guinea pigs and experimental fodder for achieving whatever it is that Psi-Cor is trying to achieve.
And I could have seen then Talia being shaped into that weapon with the promise that, oh, we have a way to fix you. That maybe she's aware of what's going on with her and she sees where this is all going to go, because her background was with a lot of these strange, if I recall correctly, wasn't she involved a little bit with the Psycops, or was that Lita that we're talking about?
That was now? Lita. Lita was...
Lita, okay.
Working but with the Psycops for a while.
You know, I would imagine still anyone in the Psi-Cor would know the cautionary tales of things that had happened. And she had heard all the stories of what had been done to the rogues and to the ones on the telepath underground, the underground
right.
railroad that Franklin was helping with.
Right.
And maybe, you know, that might have something to do, too, with why the whole emo path thing didn't work so well, was because in the first and second season, they built up the horror stories of these rogue telepaths. And then when we finally see some that are trying to carve out a world of their own, it just doesn't match that as well. They're too sanitized, if you will.
Sure. Yeah, I agree with that. And to the whole concept of what might have been, what if Talia is being shaped or pushed toward becoming a weapon to fight the shadows at the behest of Sinclair?
Hmm.
Knowing that, you know, well, you're really our best, if desperate, hope for trying to combat these creatures. And, you know, that moral quandary of, well, you know, we need somebody to fight this greater evil, but what are we sacrificing? You know, what of our own humanity and our own morality are we sacrificing to combat this apparent evil?
Hmm.
By making someone become something, you know, unstable and you know, mentally ill or whatever. I don't know. I mean, I think that becomes an intriguing approach to all that.
Speculating on what Talia might have been had her arc been fully realized is kind of interesting.
Yeah, and I would also say that the other obvious bit is the budding abortive romance between Lita and Zach obviously was going to be Talia and Garibaldi. I mean, especially if you watch that first episode of, or first season, I was watching a couple first season episodes, and there are this recurrent scene where Talia is waiting for a lift, the doors slide open, there's Garibaldi standing there. You know,
yes,
and that's kind of this, you know, and even in Midnight on the Firing Line, where Talia is talking to a business contact, and yeah, some of it is exposition to let you know what it is about the telepaths and what they do, and you know they can only read surface thoughts unless they're really strong. And then Garibaldi is standing there, and he's obviously ogling her butt, and her eyes get big, and she puts an elbow in his stomach. But as she walks away, he's like, "Oh, I think I'm in love." And while that's humorous, that is the basis for that. And there's a number of relationships, you know, a number of scenes that intimate that relationship was intended to be something more than obviously what we ended up with. And certainly Garibaldi's detestation of telepaths doesn't appear until Talia is well out of this picture.
You know, what's funny is that if you want to call this maybe the alternate universe version of Babylon 5, imagine that scene from Third Space with Zach and Lita, and maybe render that with Garibaldi and Talia, and it probably wouldn't be that hard of a transplant to make.
No, I agree, because both Zach and Garibaldi are average Joes, really, ultimately. And to a certain extent, and I don't see that as a problem. I mean, Garibaldi implies a couple times with Zach that the reason he's brought Zach along the way he has is that he recognizes something of himself in Zach. So, you know, to your point, John, yes, that works because the characters are similar, but not because it's bad writing. It's just that that's the kind of guys they are.
No, I think it also just speaks to the fact that there is so much about Talia that got kind of shifted over to Lita. It was probably one of the most natural shifts in terms of transplanting a character arc from one to the other. That one was much smoother than some of the other ones were, in my opinion.
Sure.
At least.
Sorry, go ahead.
I wonder if if having it be that the Vorlons manipulated the races to create telepaths, I wonder if that was added in there at that time to provide a reason for why she would get stronger. Because we know why Talia would be getting stronger. We, you know, Ironheart modified her. She was getting, we saw like two instances of her telekinetic ability getting stronger.
Yeah.
And then she's gone. So we had to have a reason why Lita would be able to progress in her abilities.
Hmm.
Interesting. I'm curious now. I'm like, was the Vorlon manipulation put in there afterwards to explain why Lita is now progressing at a non-typical rate?
Yeah, and I'm trying to think when the first references are made to when telepaths appear in Earth history in the show. And I'm unfortunately drawing a blank because there's too much of the Psycor trilogy in my head to filter that part of it out.
It had to have been sitting with an episode with Bester, one of the early episodes with Bester.
The first overt line that I can that pops into my head is Morden throwing out that line in Zaha Doom of why do you think certifiable telepaths appeared 100-some years ago or something to that effect.
Yeah, but that's, I mean,
that was
that's well way down the line.
Yeah,
right. Yeah,
right.
That's way down the line.
Did it come up in, what was it, Legacies?
Let me check.
I don't know.
I do remember, though, wasn't there a line very early in where someone said something about the Vorlons didn't like telepaths?
Well, I think there's something in Deathwalker and all that, that there's some concern about that, but that's a different thing. I mean, yeah, that's a different thing than making them. Mm-hmm. Yeah, right here. Here's an unanswered question in Deathwalker. Why don't Vorlons like telepaths?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's what I'm wondering if maybe Summer's right in that it was just an easy way to introduce Leeta and kind of bootstrap her into the Talia role. And
now,
the Vorlons may not have been involved in the original concept at all.
Now, right, here's something else interesting. What if originally both the Shadows and the Vorlons wanted to avoid telepaths? For the same reason, it affected their ability to manipulate the younger races.
Well, sure. I mean, if there was any one person who could see through the ruse of the Vorlons, you would think it would be a telepath because the telepath is reading would read thoughts, you know, in other words, even if the Vorlons are projecting things telepathically so that any given race sees what they want them to see, you would think a telepath would be at the very least able to work through that. And in the Shadow of Zaha Doom, while Talia doesn't necessarily see the shadows, she does know that there's something up with Morden.
Yeah. Now, that would be interesting if telepaths wouldn't be affected by the telepathic projection that the Vorlons use.
Well, the only thing that kind of counters that is that Leeta in the pilot seemed to react in the same general way that, like, the Len reacted to Kosh, which was supposed to be because of this angelic form. At least that was that's the interpretation that I took from it. I don't think that she would have seen his true form, which... Then again, at that point, she was only a P5 or whatever, so...
Right.
Maybe that has something to do with it, too.
Right. Well, and since you brought up the gathering, John, I mean, one of the supreme ironies is that Leeta was supposed to be the station's telepath, and of course, Pat Tallman didn't get the role for whatever reason, and so they cast Andrea Thompson as Talia Winters to pick up that thread because they needed to tell the story, and then of course she went off the show, so they brought Leeta back to...
Yeah, so did Leeta really take over Talia's arc, or did she just take back her arc?
Her arc.
Interesting. Okay, we're going to let everybody ponder on that while we take a really, really quick break and find more little things to nitpick on.
Optimal health is more than eating right.
You figure out, okay, here's what I'm allowing myself, calories, carbs, protein, and you spread it out. That way your body can actually absorb the nutrition properly, mm-hmm. and it can work in your favor because it's going to help you prevent muscle loss.
Good nutrition and the right exercise are the things that affect us all.
Yes, let's talk about back fat today. In fact, we could just title this episode Back Fat.
Join Romy Nelson, Ingredients for Life.
Visit RomyNelson.com.
And we're back with more. I'm sure a lot more telepath questions will come up. I want to see that telepath movie, damn it. I do.
Yeah, well, I wonder if we would have gotten the telepath war had Talia stayed in place and the amount of storytelling time that was lost in trying to reintegrate Lita back into the show. Because, again, she doesn't really reappear until the third season. She shows up, of course, in Divided Loyalty at the end of the second year, but she doesn't show up till later in the third. So, you know, was there basically traction lost on that general arc that might had Talia been there, that we might have gotten more of a telepath war instead of the emopaths?
I don't know.
It would make sense for her sacrifice a la Lita in the telepath war to make sense as the end of her character arc. As I said, it makes sense for her to go from the most loyal telepath on Babylon 5 to the freedom fighter.
Yeah, she could easily have been the leader of the rogues at the start of the war.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. But I have questions about characters we never got to see.
Ooh. Oh, yes.
Now, I had a copy of the Series Bible Season 1, which is originally dated May 20th, 1993. Mm-hmm. I've had that for years, literally years. And it was always kind of cool to go through and go, look, on this date, they had not yet cast Susan Ivanova. They had not yet cast Dr. Franklin. They had not yet cast Catherine Sakai. But the most curious I was about was a character listed in the supporting character, someone who was supposed to be a human, a regular.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the boss obviously morphed into Nagrath. I think that's kind of obvious. Mm-hmm. But Mr. Jones doesn't sound anything like Morden.
Doesn't sound like anybody.
Yeah.
Right.
Now, have you read this, John?
Yes, I actually I have it in storage right now, but I also had my copy from, I guess, did you get yours from the station?
Yes.
Back when, yes.
Way back when, yeah.
Right, I remember exactly what you're talking about. It was that character that it was, okay, everything else kind of makes sense, but this one is just mysteriously absent.
Yeah, he's not there at all. The description from a sinister feeling kind of feels like Mr. Morden, but the description of just him just being there and being... no one knows what he's doing. It's like he's a mercenary more than a facilitator. So who was Mr. Jones and what was he supposed to do?
Well, it sounds like reading through it, because it is in volume 15, the Bible, and I'm actually looking at it right now. It sounds like he was simply to be a wild card in the stack, because it is pointed out that he does things for his own purposes, but it's not that he's not to be unhelpful. He could be helpful if he wants. As it says here, he's a figure of rumor and legend, absolutely and completely dangerous, but we're never sure which side he's on other than his own. From time to time, he may be of assistance to our characters or work against them. So, you know, I take that to mean he was going to be a wild card, that whatever Straczynski might need to introduce into the story, he might be that gateway.
Mm-hmm. But the fact that he interacts with the command staff and the ambassadors, he knows who they are, they know who he is. And it's like, is he supposed to be a fixer? Is he supposed to be on no one's side but his own? Who is he? What is he supposed to do? You know, it's like the lone line. He doesn't start fights, but he finishes them.
Right.
You know? what was this character supposed to do? Because you get no hint of it from the season one Bible.
Right. And there's no analog at all at any point in the series where you can look at it and say, like you say, the boss, which is listed in the Bible, is obviously Nagrath. And Nagrath didn't play out anywhere near what I think Joe had hoped would happen with him. And frankly, in terms of how the story evolved, nobody misses Nagrath particularly much. You know, I mean, for any time you needed a crime boss and down below, you know, Deuce fit the bill as well as Nagrath, as well as Hoshi, the one guy they had in Dust to Dust.
You're right.
You know, I mean, those guys really are ultimately all interchangeable. So I don't think we miss him, but I'm puzzled. I can't the just only from the description of the outfit, simply the outfit, Abbott comes to mind, but that character is completely different than what Mr. Jones is described as here. Abbott is much more of a garrulous figure.
Right, and not somebody you would see rubbing elbows with all the ambassadors.
I suspect that the character aspects listed here and Mr. Jones got rolled into Kosh.
Kosh? No. Yeah.
I don't know about that.
Yeah, and here's part of why I think that. Let me find the line here. Number one is because nobody knows anything about him. Okay, and that's and the reason I say rolled into Kosh is more because they seem to be too similar, and maybe that's why Joe got rid of him. He's an enigmatic. He's a figure of rumor and legend. Well, that describes Kosh.
Well, no, but look at the page right before Mr. Jones is a description of Kosh. You know,
right? But that's
an ambassador. It is.
Well, yes, this is what he says about Kosh. Nothing whatsoever is known about Kosh. Stories should use him as an enigmatic figure, the X factor in all crises. His agenda is a complete mystery. Now, for Mr. Jones, he is a figure of rumor and legend, a mysterious and enigmatic human whose origin is utterly unknown. We're never sure which side he's on. Some say he's very old. Hold on. And now here's the thing. He will sometimes provide Sinclair with some necessary information, but always unasked. He seems downright wary of Dr. Franklin, won't let the doctor get anywhere near him. Mr. Jones is a mystery and will stay that way for some time. So I guess when I say rolled into it, I think when I read that... Now, especially as a Bible, those two characters are just too similar to each other.
No. The one that squashes the Koshness of it is he holds
Squash court. The Kosh?
Yeah, he holds court and does business every day at the same table in the bazaar. From time to time, he may be of assistance to our characters or work against them. He doesn't have to do anything he doesn't want to do. If you try to force the issue, you'll end up with at least half your limbs broken. How is that?
Yeah, well, because Kosh, I mean, in this sense, yes, Kosh doesn't stand around the Zocalo waiting for people to show up. But he's not going to do anything that he doesn't want to do, and you can't make him do anything you want to do. And if you try to, you're going to likely end up with broken bones.
You know, I'm looking at this, and I'm having maybe this is just completely baseless speculation.
Okay.
But to Tim's point...
Okay.
That's true. But this is really pulling it out of the ether a little bit. This almost reminds me of something like a recurring version of Mr. Sebastian. Like working for the Vorlons, where Kosh is kind of standoffish and only gets involved when it has to do with the grander scheme of things. This is like the facilitator. This would be the character that kind of pushing people along as they need to go, but just because it says he seems to be older than he appears. He's you know, enigmatic about his background. He doesn't want Dr. Franklin to look at him at all. These little things just remind me of the fact that you've got these people that the Vorlons have kind of formed into their servitors.
Yeah, Sebastian fits it better. Sebastian does fit it a lot better.
Yeah, okay. I mean,
equal but opposite to a Morden.
Sure. Sure. Two sides of the same coin that way.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, all right.
I'll buy that.
But yeah, no, just seeing that description of the wild card who's in play, who's allowed to stay on the station because nobody can get rid of him. Garibaldi can't figure him out. I mean, really, Garibaldi can't figure him out? Who is this guy?
Right.
You know? It's like
that might have been intriguing.
At the same time, when we're talking about a story that has been blocked out in such detail, to have a wild card character is almost, you know, and the antithesis of all of that. He may have put that in there with the intention of whenever he needs a character like that that can push things along, and yet he doesn't have to have a clear agenda quite yet, but then realized pretty early on maybe that didn't fit the world that he was building quite the right way.
Right. Yeah, because if you're yeah, no, that does make sense, because having a character like that who you could have do anything you want, that's your Deus Ex Machina in the back pocket. That's your Q from Star Trek trying to come in and just stir things up or fix things because he can. That's a crutch.
That matter, to Tim's point, Kosh was kind of like that at the beginning, or at least seemed like it.
And as Straczynski notes in comments about Grail on the Lurker's Guide, that it was going to be Kosh originally that blasts the Nakaline feeder, saying we don't allow some things to exist, but that was too much like the end of Deathwalker, where the Vorlons come out of the jump gate and blow her ship up and say, you guys aren't ready for immortality. Mm-hmm. And that becomes a trap. And I think Straczynski was aware of that early on. And maybe that's part of why the boss character, or not the boss character, the Mr. Jones character never made an appearance, because it could have been that kind of thing. The other thing is, I'm reading this, it almost seems, you know, as you reading and thinking about the characters, even as they played out in the series, so many of them are opposite sides of the same coin. You know, obviously Londo and Jakar, you know, that relationship, they're two of a kind that way. Lanier and Veer, again, opposites and yet the same. Mm-hmm. And reading this bit in the Bible, it seems to me that Mr. Jones was to be the antithesis of the boss. And there's even a line here that says, where Mr. Jones has always been Mr. Jones, the boss has a number of aliases and identities. So I wonder if Joe might have been planning some kind of, that would have been yet another character arc to run through as a thread through the 10-year saga of B5 and B.P.
Mm. Right, and once one was not a viable character, then the counterpart would not have been really meant to get into. If we say that Nagrath was supposed to be the boss, then as quickly as he dropped out of the story, then bringing Mr. Jones in maybe wasn't viable anymore from a structural point of view.
Right. Right, that's my point.
Hmm.
Interesting.
Very.
What else you got, Summer?
We could talk about the joke script.
Well, you know, there's one other thing that I do want to touch on before we get to that, and this is sort of
this is the antithesis of the what might have been. Looking through like the outline, the treaties that were handed over, the treatises, excuse me, that were created and pitched for the studio heads. As Joe even freely notes, that so much of that was just simply generated to try to make it understandable to studio bosses who would sign off on that and were not ever really considered where the story was going to go. You know, I'm thinking specifically of like the concept art that was created. You know, interesting to look at, but really they had no intention of going in any direction visually like what you saw there. Similarly, there's a line in one of the pitches where Straczynski says, "We're going to have an overall story, but every episode will be able to stand alone." Well, wow, if you could do that.
Yeah, not so much.
So I just thought that was interesting to read and kind of contrast with all the speculation we've been doing. So, yes. Then we have the joke script for the exercise of vital powers.
All right. I just have to say, on behalf of the Narn regime, we do not in any way acknowledge the existence of this scene.
So you could give us the proper pronunciation of Tukado or Tukado.
Which one do you think it is? The second one sounds an awful lot more. There's a whole song about that, sung on certain holidays on the Narn calendar.
I think it's more interesting the story behind the story. even down to the crew member who saw the pages. Well, for people who aren't up on exactly what we're talking about, Peter Jurasik and Andreas Katsoulis pulled a practical joke on JMS, and I don't even remember what that is. It's not referenced here in this particular volume, so if you guys know what it is, please chime in. But to get his revenge, Straczynski waited for the proper time, and we're talking all the way into the fourth season, and he developed this storyline for the exercise of vital powers where Jakar undergoes a transformation from a male to a female Narn and winds up in bed with Londo. And, to not dwell in a whole lot, but basically Jurasik goes to Joe and says, "Okay, this is really funny. You know, that's pretty funny. What a great joke." And Straczynski's comment is, he says, it's the line he had been sitting on waiting for the right moment to say, "I write 10 hours a day. Well, I don't have time to write jokes."
Well, the best part, too, is that in order to make the joke stick and to sell it to Peter Jurasik, he actually had people doing wardrobe fittings and chess casts for Andreas.
Oh, yeah, yes. Right. Yep. Yeah. Yeah. They actually did a lot of production work on the scene that never got shot.
Yeah. The best part of his description of his intro is how he described how Jerry Doyle just happened to be in the area that day. Yeah. And oh, by the way, our studios, our sets are out in the armpit of the valley. Nobody's out there just happening to be out there if they didn't have to be there. And he says, quote, "I read the script," he said. "Very funny. Great joke." I met his gaze levelly. "It's not a joke, Jerry. We're shooting it." "Come on," he said. "This is revenge for what they did to you at the convention." "I didn't say it wasn't revenge," I replied, "but we're still shooting it. It's not a joke. This is the next episode. If you've ever seen Bugs Bunny disappear into a bug-shaped cloud of dust, you've just seen Jerry's exit that day." And just the fact that he's able to maintain it up until the very, 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 very end, even to the point of getting them to supply prosthetic female Narn parts. Oh my goodness.
And of course, the coda. Not long thereafter, I ran into Peter, and now suddenly it was funny, and he was saying maybe we should shoot it after all. We still can, I said ominously.
Yeah, right.
He dropped it. it almost would have been worth seeing the test footage for...
Yeah. And his comment is that at that point in the production, everybody has gotten used to weird things coming out of Joe's typewriter. You know? The thing that Londo is using to cheat with cards is actually his genitalia.
Yep.
Right. Yep. Anyway.
That's right. So is there anything else we can gnaw on from the what might have beens?
Well, that's all I've got for now, but I'm sure other people will come up with some for us to gnaw further upon. That's what I love about this job.
Oh, yeah. We get to speculate because we can. If that isn't true love, I don't know what is.
Yeah, right. What other series do you have the opportunity of taking apart, even on a conceptual basis?
You know, that's the one wonderful thing about Babylon 5 and the experiment that JMS decided to do at the time was to document so much of what he was intending to do and what he was doing day to day and the story progressing and all the communication that he's given. We've got so much fodder to play with in terms of what might have been and even down to what could have happened if they had just a little bit more money and things like that. It invites it because we have so much information and... As you say, it's just you get deep enough into this show, you can't help it.
Right. And I think the other part of it is it's such a rich universe that hasn't been mined yet. And I hate to bring up our favorite whipping boy, but you know, Star Trek at this point, that mine has been tapped out. That vein really needs to kind of lie fallow for a while, the J.J. Abrams movie notwithstanding. And I mean, look at, I'll say it, the Voices of Babylon. I think what you guys have done with Three Edged Sword and what I think is going to go on with some of the one shots that you're planning, that's just an opportunity to explore that universe because nobody else is doing it. Because it's truly that rich. There's just so much there. And Straczynski has laid it out. This isn't like, you know, fans sitting around going, you know, golly, what if this had happened? It's like it's like Joe laid all these little hooks around and said, okay, well, here's a hook for a story, and here's a hook for a story, and here's a hook for a story, and here's three for another, and they're just waiting there.
Mm-hmm. And you know what? The only other series I can think of that has laid such a foundation where a million people can run off in a million different directions and not damage the original story is Firefly.
Yeah, I can agree with that.
And the biggest difference there being is that it was left open almost unintentionally.
Mm-hmm.
With only the handful of episodes that you had. Here we have a five-season arc. We've got a few you know, TV movies. We've got Crusade, which is a huge open ground for speculation and what might have been. I'm sure that would be a complete set of episodes right there. But no, to Tim's point and to your point, when we look at Voices of Babylon, what's funny is that when we look at that story that we've been doing on Orion 7, that in and of itself is just such a self-contained little sliver of what's available out there for deeper exploration. And you can do an entire story about, you know, what the religious figures that we saw at the end of season 3 were doing during the crisis on Earth. Little things like that, where it's just,
right.
you could take a one-shot character that showed up once or twice, and there's so many things that were never really done with that because it it really didn't pertain to the story of Babylon 5, but it was part of the richer universe. Just look at that. The monks that were on there in season 3, we got a glimpse of that, but we didn't see nearly as much as what could have been and maybe might have been.
I agree with that completely. And there's your other might have been, the fact that we get monks of some religious order in deconstruction of falling stars that are keeping the flame of civilization alight 500 years after the Great Burn. You know, one could wonder whether or not those are Brother Edward's descendants. And what a story that would be to tell, how, you know, such an order remains, how they change with the times and yet remain intact.
I have a theory on that, but I don't know if we have the time.
All right, well, we'll save that for next show then.
There you go. And of course, there's the whole story of what might have happened to Sinclair when he went back to become Valen. And you could tell an entire series on that. I actually would like to see John Hamm from Mad Men, Don Draper, play. If Michael O'Hare can't come back, I think that he would make an interesting Valen.
It's all about the bone, so, you know.
There you go. But come on. He's got the stentorian voice.
Yeah.
Well, we have gnawed our particular favorite bones to the nub.
Yummy.
Or something. And you know what to do in case you want to submit your own theories and speculations for alternative B5 goodness that might have been. Those email addresses are babylonpodcast@gmail.com, summer@sliceofsci-fi.com, brett@sliceofsci-fi.com, forums, farpointforums.com. Look for the Babylon Podcast section and speculate away, because you never know. We may just pick one of your topics and expound on it for an episode. And, of course, BabylonPodcast.com. Come visit the website. Share your comments. Donate to the show if you like what we're doing, because it is August here. We have like another month and a half of like plus 100 degree weather. So help Mike keep the studio cool. And, of course, the phone number to call in your voicemail. That number is 206-338-2259. That's 206-338-2259.
Here, we speculate that maybe we should do a voicemail show.
And we will see you next time on the other side of the, speculative jump gate? Yeah, that worked.
There might be one.